After Action Report, 8 November 1942. Early on the evening of November 8th, a radio distress signal was received from HMT Akita, reporting that, while as part of a convoy transiting northbound out of the Irish Sea en route to Iceland, she struck a mine and was experiencing engine trouble. A rescue force, made up of 3 motor torpedo boats of the newly formed 4th Irish Coastal Flotilla out of Lough Swilly, accompanied by a Fairmile motor torpedo boat of the Royal Navy acting as flotilla leader, was dispatched. Owing to reports of heightened German activity in the North Atlantic and a second such squadron was dispatched to accompany the first. As the rescue squadron approached the Akita, the radio man aboard became agitated, reporting the approach of a large warship and an unknown number of smaller craft, believed to be German. An observer aboard the lead Royal Navy vessel confirmed the sighting of a VP boat accompanied by 2 E-boats. They further reported that they were closing to evacuate the Akita's crew. The boat swiftly came under heavy enemy fire, and additional torpedo boats were called forward to assist in the evacuation, while the second Royal Navy vessel attempted a delaying action. This was followed shortly by the sighting of an M-class minesweeper and an additional E-boat. Following the destruction of the lead rescue boat, the remainder of the initial rescue squadron pulled alongside the Akita and evacuated the crew under very heavy fire, though they gave good account of themselves, destroying 2 E-boats that were evidently attempting to capture the ship and crew, with the assistance of the Akita's remaining cannon. The second Royal Navy vessel attempted to close with the minesweeper, laying smoke to obscure the rescue operations, and was accompanied by 2 Irish torpedo boats to cover the retreat of the remaining rescue force. All 3 boats were lost in the attempt, though sufficient damage was done to the M-class vessel that the surviving German craft were forced to withdraw. The last known position and heading of the German vessels was passed on to the Royal Navy and Irish Fleet commands. Owing to the presence of a VP boat, no air pursuit was ordered. Of note, the crews of the rescue flotilla reported that no less than 5, and potentially as high as 8 torpedoes were believed to have successfully been aimed at the German vessels, most notably the minesweeper, but no visible detonations were reported, and the accumulated damage done to the vessels appears to be entirely due to cannon and machine gun fire. Details of this report and the torpedoes in question have been forwarded to...
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Plastic Press Gang Podcast, a podcast about playing historical games very unseriously. My name is Calvin, I use he, him pronouns, and I'm learning about why pop filters exist.
And my name is Eric, I use he, him pronouns, and I am learning why you shouldn't buy a webcam that doesn't have drivers for your operating system.
We're all having a good time tonight with... pieces of equipment that we should know how to use logically with how often we use them, but who knows.
So Calvin, what have you been working on?
Well, what I've been working on today is I started more work on the lovely Germans that were featured in that wonderful battle report that we did at the top of the episode. Right now on my desk is the only half-painted flak boat, which we discovered is horrifying.
An absolute menace.
Against everything. And I had the now known as, you know, the German Gibraltar little minesweeper that just loves getting those tactical bonks. Just 6 tactical bonks on him.
Six torpedoes that managed to strike said ship. 4 of them didn't hit, and the 2 that did hit were both duds, selling me extremely well on the value of having bunches of torpedoes. I was very proud of my torpedo aiming and like bracketing his ships, and then no, nothing happens. I was totally ready in my heart to take down a minesweeper with a torpedo. It did not happen.
Well, I mean, also in addition to that, you launched more than 7. I think you launched what, 12? Something
like
that.
There was at least 12. We were genuinely running short of torpedo markers at one point, and had to go to we are just going to arbitrarily assign torpedoes to activations because we can no longer keep track of whose torpedoes are who. Because I had 9 ships, 8 of which had at least 2 torpedo tubes, and we fired them all.
Yeah, it was an entertaining time. And I will slightly, you know, plug myself slightly in that I did a pretty good job of dodging about half of them.
With some very slow ships.
Yeah, it's like the flak boat does not move very fast or very maneuverably, but we figured it out. Other things that I painted recently include the fact that the Spaniards are done.
Asterix.
They need to be based and varnished because I don't own any varnish.
Yes, and you do not base. So that is what I'm working on is
I last night made little green stuff sausages to merge in between the bases themselves and the base of the model, because I hate that transition being really sharp. So we have smoothed that out with some green stuff, and then today the bases will be painted and based. So yeah, that is what I have been... That was the primary thing I've been working on. I also, for Cruel Seas, was inspired afterwards to assemble Skytrax/Warlord Games is putting out a fundraiser model for the HMS Medusa, which is a harbor defense boat. It's a little tiny thing with some cannons on it. So I was assembling that. It's a weird model. The main body of the model is a 3D print and is obviously a 3D print, and I don't mind that. And then the guns are metal. And 3D printed resin and metal is a weird combination that I don't think I've ever encountered before. So that was sort of funny. It's definitely got a sort of weird cognitive dissonance to it. Although it's probably good that this little skinny mast that it has is not in resin, because resin likes to snap.
Yeah. Also, I'm pretty sure like they just have like those are the metal kits they have for the guns and crew that they have for everything. But there are some other things that I have been working on. Like, I based all my SAS and LRDG infantry.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you. And then also I started on a few new projects, or one of them's a finishing, which is I do have all my LRDG trucks now built. Not painted yet, but they're built. So that's an army I've wanted for almost a decade, ready to go. The French for the Hundred Years' War have been bought built, and like I've painted half of a unit. We'll get there eventually. Things have been busy with me doing things not historical.
Yeah, you've been trying to get back into 40k a bit.
Yeah, which is weird that I'm actually doing stuff for 40k. Like, I have an Armiger on my desk that is converted with various bits and pieces. It's a weird feeling.
That has also been a thing for me. Our local crusade group is getting started again, and I am the GM for that. So I have been 3D printing a Hive City board for folks to play on. If you want a picture of it, join our Patreon. It's on our Discord. And as it turns out, I was being a little bit conservative with how much space people were willing to allocate to that board. People have gotten fairly excited about it. And so it's now on a much larger sheet of plywood than I was expecting. So I've got room for more stuff. So last night I printed a jail so people can then jailbreak horrible criminals and turn them into Space Marines or something. It's been a sort of a variety pack of things. Similarly, on projects started, I finished out the 3D printing we're doing for the What a Stormtrooper demo game. I now need to get painting those. And I also bought, it is quasi-historical and may turn into full historical, The Old World has come out. And there's a couple folks playing The Old World at the local club. And I generally try to support people playing specialist games. So I sort of schemed out a Bretonian Exiles Border Princes force that's sort of heavy on infantry, but has a couple cool knight units, etc. Had a 2,000 point list set up, ordered some Perry miniatures to do that. And then Games Workshop hit us all with their, yeah, remember how we sold you on this with Cathay and Kislev? Neither one of those are coming to the Old World anytime soon. Which, of course, for Games Workshop actually means, like, they're not on the release schedule yet. They may come someday. They may not. Who knows? But it's not a terribly, like, morale-boosting bit of news to have gotten. And so part of me has sort of gotten less interested in The Old World. Because, like, that was about playing a game that people are playing at the club. And if this dies, I don't really need a third-party Bretonian army sitting around in my life. So I'm going to drag my feet on that project a little bit as the plastic soldiers make their way across the Atlantic, and that may get converted into Hundred Years' War models, Italian
Continental
wars.
Knights.
Yes, assorted Continental Knights. Because I'm looking at this and going, I have an enormous Lion Rampart army if I just do Lion Rampart instead. So yeah, that's about it for models painted and projects launched.
There is one more idea that has hit the, check the bingo box for, Calvin had an idea. Which is, also you can check the mark that Calvin's playing the French, because the free sprue I got with my Long Range Desert Group guys was the new Warlord World War II French sprue. And it's real good. It's real pretty. And that's dangerous. So luckily, one of our other friends, Kai, that we've spoken of quite a bit, who loves doing his historicals, is offering to play the Germans this time around. So I get to play the French. And that might happen at some point. That might be a 2025 project for me.
I also similarly backed a Kickstarter for some British Expeditionary Force guys. So I may end up there as well, because I do like, as I've been sort of researching the topic for this month's, weeks, whatever this is, episode, I did do a lot more reading into the early portions of the Second World War. And honestly, I think a lot of that's really quite engaging. And so I would fully be down with that. So yeah.
There's one more thing I just realized that I did do since last podcast.
Calvin is an evil Steve Jobs with his one more things.
One more thing. I did finish building my epic pike and shot army. So they'll get primed at some point when the weather's not garbage.
Yeah, that has been a hindrance on progress here, is the weather has been garbage. 2 days ago was good priming weather. I got one thing done and then I had to go to work. And I was like, oh, maybe it'll be nice this weekend. Listener, it was not nice this weekend.
Wind advisory? They have those?
Yeah, I live at the top of a hill, so I know exactly what it sounds like when my house is essentially resonating due to wind. I don't like it. So yeah. Any particular games played besides the one we've already mentioned for Cruel Seas?
Not for historicals, but there have been... There's a game that I saw just previewed that I think would be something we could give a try, which is... there's a rule system from a company, WIP, Work in Progress Miniatures, called On Bloody Ground. I just saw a video about it that the Seven Sun channel put out, and it looks... interesting. And for a 15 pound rulebook, $20 rulebook, that's like, hey, this is good for, like, the two supplements they have out right now are like, hey, here is all the rules plus army lists for, you know, Anglo-Saxons and Normans fighting each other, and here's all the rules with army lists for the Reconquista. And so that's one of the things where I looked at and like, we could potentially try that out. It'll be about the same size as Lion Rampant, but mm-hmm. It looks interesting.
Yeah, that's worth checking out. So we watched the same video, and that did make me also ponder. I have been subscribing to Reconquer Designs on my mini factory, and part of me has a, what if I just 3D printed a Reconquista army? Partially because I am considering buying another 3D printer, this one to replace my somewhat long in the tooth resin printer, which is... starting to show its age. It's a if you give a mouse a cookie problem that immediately Midwesterners go, do you mean if you give a moose a muffin? No, I mean if you give a mouse a cookie. That's the book of my childhood, where I have a wash and cure station for my resin printer, which is absolutely essential. But the original design for these, which is a bad design, has two magnets that are immersed in the cleaning solution, which in my case is isopropyl alcohol. Isopropyl alcohol is a pretty strong solvent. The magnets start falling apart. And so you get little clumps of essentially ferrite hanging around in your washing solution. They occasionally glue themselves to miniatures, and that's really annoying. So I was like, I need a new bucket for my wash and cure machine. They don't sell buckets for the wash and cure machine I have anymore because it's like three generations out of date. Also, the wash and cure station's motor when it starts up sounds about like what I do in the morning when I start up, and that's not good. And so I'm replacing that. And then while I was replacing that, I was like on the Elegoo website being like, huh, we could get a larger format machine, you say. So that may be in the works because part of me just wants to 3D print a beautiful looking Reconquista army.
I mean, as long as there's a few spots in there for, you know, various forces for the Third Crusade to make an appearance, because it's about the same time.
Yeah, that's easy enough, because we are talking about the alternate history episode, which means we can do whatever we want.
Segways!
Yep, this is a good segue to our main topic, which is a discussion of wargaming alternate history, sort of what that means, and how we in particular go about it. The acknowledgement I will put here is this is very much my jam. Not necessarily Calvin's, although I am slowly convincing Calvin that it's worth doing. So this is going to be a slightly Eric-heavy episode. If you don't like hearing my voice, maybe now is the time to go listen to another podcast. This is definitely my jam, is a little bit going to be Eric-skewed. But with that, Calvin, what are we thinking about when we talk about alternate history?
When we're talking about alternate history, we separate this from the things that are quasi-historical, of things like Silver Bayonet, Gloom Trench, where it's like, no, these are still mostly things that could be happening. This is not demons are running around during the First World War, and we're not hunting vampires during the Napoleonic Wars. This is, you hit one button to change a thing, and all of a sudden, oh, the Irish are in World War II, for example.
Purely hypothetically speaking.
Yeah. Or what if, you know, the English actually held on to, like, Normandy after the Hundred Years' War? Like, little things like that, where it's like, huh, things that are one event changes things.
Yeah, we also distinguish between this and what some folks have referred to as imaginations, where you essentially take a historical setting, but the countries in it are purely fictional. So, like, the best example of this for most people's childhood is the two countries, I can't remember what they are, who are fighting in The Princess Bride. They are historical feeling nations, but are not real. So, for example, if you wanted to just, you know, make up something, Henry Hyde has a whole book that is a campaign of his about nations that don't exist, which gives you a similar type of flexibility. But yeah, this is specifically in that, what if something about history changed and that thing is not that there are vampires?
Yeah, which still gives us lots of fun things to play with. What if they invaded, you know, the Nordic countries? Like, what if they actually did land troops there?
Yeah.
Bad idea.
We're going to talk about two types of alternate history. This is a classification I came up with. Big change alternate history and little change alternate history. And then the question is, which one do we prefer? And the answer is, at least for me, I don't know that there's a version I prefer. Generally speaking, I find little change alternate history to be more fun to think about because you still have constraints. And I actually think constraints are where a lot of activity and a lot of creativity come from, is trying to figure out, okay, but if we tweak this thing, what happens? Whereas with big change history, you tend to be much more free to do whatever you want because you have now sort of wildly changed history. You can follow the knock-on implications of that. So a good example of that is, you know, the classic, what if the South won the Civil War, a la Harry Turtledove? You get the knock-on changes from the United States is split in two countries is massive. And so you get to sort of say whatever you want after that.
Yeah, it's very much a, well, go nuts. You have all the freedom in the world to do whatever you want with the big changes.
So let's segue, I think, into our examples. We're going to start with the first one, which is my baby. And this is Ireland in 1940. Briefly, there was a plan floated in 1940 when the British were sort of at their lowest in terms of, are we going to win this war that's just gotten started with Germany? There was a plan floated for the Irish to join the side of the Allies. And basically, hey, let's get you in this war in exchange for the six counties of Northern Ireland. Now, this is a fairly significant political offer. A lot of industry for the British was based in Belfast. It was a major industrial city. It's a port. So like Harland and Wolff, which is a shipyard that produced, among other things, the Titanic, is located in Belfast. And this would also unite Ireland. And at the time, the British were not terribly keen on that notion. And so this was a significant compromise. The Irish end up refusing because this was going to get them invaded by Germany, was their primary thought. And in fairness, the Germans did have an invasion plan. Hilariously, the British also had an invasion plan that is essentially, if the Germans invade Ireland, we also need to invade Ireland, but we'll be invited, and so it'll be okay. And so this is not an insane fear. You know, when we look back retrospectively on things like, could Operation Sea Lion ever have succeeded? And the answer is
no.
Yeah. Unless the Royal Navy like literally fell asleep and woke up like a month later and was like, oh, oops. This would never have worked. But at the time, it was obviously a very real fear. And so this is one example for a small change version is so Ireland joins the Allies. One of the things that's interesting here from sort of a perspective is Ireland is a small country. It's just got done with an economic war with Britain that had crippled its economy until like 1938. So it's not in great shape. The Irish Air Force in 1940 is four Gloucester Gladiators, which are fine and lovely biplanes, but it's not a modern air force and it's not very big. The Irish Navy is, for the purposes of the Second World War, effectively non-existent. There is a motor launch with a fairly substantial cannon and a couple sort of harbor defense boats and things like that. The Irish Army is two infantry divisions. So this is not a, man, if the Irish had joined in 1940, we would have been in Berlin in 43. It's not a big change, but you can start thinking about Ireland is considerably farther out in the Atlantic than Great Britain is, which means Irish ships, Irish planes, things like that could extend the air cover the Allies had for convoys and things like that, hunting U-boats, well further than was possible because you have another island sitting out in the middle of the Atlantic. You have the opportunity to look at what if there's a country that doesn't quite have the same historical hangups that other countries do. So, for example, the RAF really struggled with the fact that Bomber Command in the RAF both sort of hampered the coastal command and also didn't think tactical bombing was going to be a thing. Bombers for the British were designed to deprive their enemies of their industrial bases rather than like, let's go bomb a tank column. That turned out to be a problem in the early 1940 era. And so what if you have an Irish Air Force that is being designed from the ground up and has the lessons learned from very early in the war where they can say, okay, yeah, we're going to need tactical bombers. Coastal defense is actually going to be a thing. You know, what if we change that? So there's a lot of things you can think about that. But then you have this constraint of at most the Irish are going to field a few divisions. This is not going to be like the Americans get a beach at Normandy, the British get a beach at Normandy, and the Irish get a beach at Normandy. It's going to be, what I'm aiming for is similar to the Canadians, but slightly less. So, you know, a couple divisions here and there, helping either the Irish or the Americans. And then part of the fun of this, and I think the original impetus of this, was thinking about the political acceptability of some things. So, for example, the Irish, were they going to be invaded by Germany? Their plan was essentially a guerrilla war. The Irish in the 1920s had some experience with fighting what they considered to be an occupied power with unconventional methods. So once they join the side of the Allies, they can go hog wild with commandos. And as long as nobody asks what anyone else was doing in the 1924 to 1926 period, we'll all get along fine.
For more information about that kind of stuff, there's a lovely series from the podcast Lions Led by Donkeys. It's a 4 or 5 part series on the Troubles. It's quite good.
Yeah. So you have things like that. You have things like, what tanks should we use? No self-respecting Irishman is going to get in a tank called the Cromwell.
Fuck Cromwell.
Yeah. We are going to have to buy M4s. Also, we are a little bit dependent on the U.S. Lend-Lease program, and realistically, the Irish are probably low on the priority list. So, for example, my plans for this army involve a lot of M10 Wolverines doing the heavy lifting for armor-piercing rounds, because the 76mm M4 is probably pretty low on the priority list for let's give that to the Irish. So that's an example of a small change version where you can tinker with this, but it probably doesn't change the course of the war wildly. Calvin, do you want to talk about our resident big change?
So the big change idea that we personally really like is the Cold War goes hot, which we are, for the purposes of this, not going to go with the mutual annihilation thing, because we'd rather not deal with that. There will be maybe a few nukes flying, but we are not destroying the entire world in a nuclear holocaust.
Because that's boring war game.
Yeah. And why do we like this? Nostalgia. Well, nostalgia for Eric and me, because I like weird old things.
Yeah, so for me, I'm slightly older than Calvin, and for me, Cold War era tanks and fighter jets are what I think of as like a modern war. Like, I have a soft spot for the Leopard and the Abrams and the Tomcat. These are like, when you say fighter jet, what comes to mind for me is an F-15.
Something danger zone.
Yes, something danger zone. So the Cold War is for me what I think of as a modern war, even though it's manifestly not. And for this, you also get to play.
The 80s were 40 years ago.
Yes. Somebody, if you're wanting to feel old, somebody pointed out that Tom Cruise flying an F-14 in the current Top Gun, if you map that back to when the original Top Gun was filmed, that is the equivalent of him flying around in a Spitfire. That made me feel real good when I found that out. The other thing you can get from this is both of us have a discomfort that we will probably spend a whole episode talking about a little bit, playing modern war games generally for a couple reasons. One is that we don't want to play a game where if we're playing with an opponent, we are playing the battle where their buddy died. That isn't what I'm looking for in my fun. A lot of modern warfare is inherently asymmetrical. You have a superpower.
Which can be fun.
Yes, which sometimes can be fun. But we have lots of scenarios and lots of systems for asymmetrical warfare. This is, you can break out those things and it's not asymmetrical warfare. And also, you don't have to deal with quite as many political ramifications of like what it means to be in a war in Afghanistan, et cetera, et cetera.
But it also means that we get to have these like mass tank combats, which is cool.
Yeah, that's one of the things, is in a lot of sort of asymmetrical warfare games, if a tank shows up at all, that's like a big deal. A lot of it's squad level combat and things like that. Whereas for this, yeah, you've got, you know, the British Army of the Rhine or the United States or like the entirety of West Germany trying to fight off Guards tank divisions. And so you get to show up with lots of tanks. So we have neatly segued into one of the things we've talked about, which is potential scales for this game.
Our personal favorite is 7 Days to the River Rhine, which to us is the ideal size for it, which is we have like maximum of 10 vehicles on the table aside. And it's a lot of back and forth, a lot of terrain, real quick, real deadly, how it should feel. Yeah. And we like this over Team Yankee, which would be the same scale of models, but many more of them, because the tables... an extended sigh from here until the end of the episode, like, is not for us.
Yeah, the problem that comes with Team Yankee is a game played on the scale of Team Yankee should be played on a board larger than anything we have at the club by a fair margin. And so you have things like, what is there, like, there's actual self-propelled artillery. What is that doing on the battlefield at all? Is this the Russians have broken through and are now attacking the rear lines? And is every battle that? You get what is commonly referred to as the parking lot problem, where, yep, there's just 30 BMP-1s hanging out in a line, or there's 10 Abrams tanks rolling down this road, all sort of nose to tail, versus essentially what 7 Days to the River Rhine did is they've said it should be played on the same size board, and they basically multiplied the points values in Team Yankee by 10, so that, you know, a full U.S. Army is something like 4 Abrams. Any Team Yankee starter set, which is a starter set for Team Yankee, is more models than you will ever need for 7 Days to the River Rhine.
I've got about 2 armies worth of Russians. And Russians are the Horde army, and I have more than I'll ever need of them.
Yeah. One of the things we have also been doing is looking at this sort of at a smaller scale, which is one of the ways we avoid the why isn't this just a nuclear exchange, is The idea behind our version of the Cold War Goes Hot is things got a little bit out of control rather than like Russia decided one day that they just wanted Europe. Something happened that spiraled out of control, then that spiraled out of control, the classic sort of that approach. So we've been talking about retrofitting either some modern games, so games like In Country, or World War II games, games like 0200 Hours, for very small unit actions. So this could be elite versus elite dudes, that's In Country. So, you know, Russian Spetsnaz dudes versus Navy SEALs, somebody's up to no good in some place, and then that spirals out of control. The second is elite dudes versus regulars. So you could have that again be, you know, something like, and we'll get to this, a American pilot is shot down, crashes over Sweden. Some Spetsnaz dudes are sent to go get him. They end up murdering some Swedes in the process. Something like that, where essentially this creates an international incident that if no one decides, okay, we need to back up, you potentially get a full-scale war, but you don't get the sort of scenario everybody was worried about in the Cold War, which is that either the US or Russia decides, let's just go ahead and do a nuclear strike and wipe out half the world, and then, oops, also get ourselves wiped out in the process.
Yeah, and I did look up, and there are rules that someone has written that are a port or kind of an add-on for bolt action of Cold War stuff, which we could do that, potentially. We could look at that. I think it was mainly more focused on, like, so you can do Vietnam War, but we can extrapolate from there to make the 80s work.
Yeah, both bolt action, and there's also a chain of command
Vietnam.
I can't remember if it's an official product or a fan product, but for chain of command, they're sort of the same for Vietnam. And similarly, you can extrapolate from there. One thing that we have noted we're steering away from in this, despite it probably being a major part of that conflict, is naval warfare. And that is because this is in the era of long-range missiles and things like that. There is a game that represents this. The old Hex Encounter gamers in our listening audience will recognize the word harpoon. Games like Harpoon, Seventh Fleet, or all the other various fleet games, these are wildly complex. You can play them. I have played them. They're tough. They're just hard games because they're things like, okay, what is the radar signature of the Soviet fleet at this particular point in time? Because that's going to change how many Harpoon missiles are going to hit the Soviets. And that's tricky.
And for similar reasons, it's why we're not doing air warfare, even though we have literally brought up Top Gun at least twice already. Like, as much as we want to, you know, put on our aviators and blast the Kenny Loggins, like, it's boring.
Yeah. I do have a Hex Encounter game for that called NATO Air Controller. Well, I've got a couple, but the one I'm thinking about is NATO Air Controller, which is hilariously a solitaire game where you are basically trying to keep planes going whilst the Russians come at you. It hits a little bit different in the year of our Lord 2024, but is potentially a fun game.
Another thing I was going to point out is that the other main part of naval warfare would be submarine warfare, because I have watched Hunt for Red October an embarrassing number of times. And while I would love to do a submarine game, that's a Hex Encounter game.
Yeah.
Or something like Captain Sonar, which I would love to get eight people together to do a game of Captain Sonar.
Yeah, there's some potential there. So we do have an alternate history bonus round that is essentially a little change inside the big change, and is for me, because again, this is my jam, and also this gets to check the box of Eric plays the Swedes, is what if the Swedes join NATO, effectively? And for this, again, this is sort of a reasonable thing to have happened. The Swedes are ostensibly neutral in the Cold War, but they're neutral in a way that they end up sharing intelligence with NATO, and they're mostly buying either Western equipment or their own stuff. They are definitely leaning NATO. Like, their plans for repelling an invasion are not repelling an invasion from Norway. And a number of credible Soviet plans for invading Norway, particularly, involve going ahead and just skipping through Sweden and saying, get out of the way. So this is essentially a question of what if Sweden joins the side of the NATO forces in the Cold War? This way I get to use their incredibly wonky and lovely S tank, the main battle tank that is also secretly just a tank destroyer and also has hydraulic hoppers. I love it to death. It's goofy.
The angry cheese wedge.
Yeah. And so you get a really interesting sort of scenario and a fun one because we don't know how this went. So the S tank, I don't know if it ever actually fired in anger at anything. So we have no idea if this was a good idea or not. So we can sort of spitball on ways we want it to work. This is, again, one of these, probably this gets a little bit out of hand. You know, a NATO ship is in trouble. The Swedes go to rescue it for humanitarian reasons. They get torpedoed by a Russian submarine. This is a whole thing. Or again, either the, you know, Norwegians, Americans, whatever, violate Swedish neutrality, or the Russians do, or maybe they both do, but Sweden reacts to them slightly differently. The Norwegians get warning shots. The Soviets get kill shots. The Soviets get mad at this and invade. There's lots of ways to sort of justify this working. But again, Sweden entering the Cold War is not going to, like, that isn't the tipping point that either makes NATO win or lose. It's just, okay, now things are a little bit different.
Things are more interesting.
So these are both primarily modern examples. We also came up with a more medieval slash pushing, you know, Crusades era one, which is some Viking presence remains in Britain post 1066.
So like they are not fully defeated in 1066 before, you know, the Normans do their thing.
Yeah.
This could be a big deal, TM.
Yeah, this feels small. Harald doesn't lose a battle to Harald right before Harald loses a battle to William. But this is potentially a very large change. Questions like, what happens to the Crusades? Because there's potentially, if there is a large Scandinavian power in England, is sort of Viking culture now robust to conversion to Christianity? If so, is there a crusade into that part of England rather than a crusade towards the Holy Land? Is there essentially a British Reconquista? That's sort of an interesting question. How long does this, what we put in here is New Dane Law, how long does that last? Is this, there are, you know, Danes in England for another 50 years? Or is this 1857 or 12 crusades later? Things like this. Does this just wholesale prevent a United Kingdom? Does Scotland and Wales and Ireland continue to just be independent? Essentially, if you don't have 1066 go fully well for the Normans, there is then not, less than 100 years later, a Norman invasion of Ireland, because presumably they're somewhat preoccupied with the folks actually in their own country. So this is potentially a big change. And this is one where this can potentially spiral wildly out of control, where like Denmark is a global superpower.
Which could be interesting.
Or you can then keep it very close to the actual timeline we're talking about and be like, okay, let's talk about this in light of the Norman conquest of England, in light of 100 years after that, 50 years after that, the, you know, the first through third crusades, things like that, to try to ground things a little bit more. One of the questions is just, how do the crusades go if Norman England isn't as available to go crusading because they're busy? There's a lot of questions like that. Now, there's a number of systems that just handle this. Saga, Lion Rampant, etc., have the mechanisms to just go, okay, cool, let's play that out. You know, Vikings, you have heavy elite infantry, and not a lot of horsemen. Normans, you get lots of cavalry and
crossbows.
Then sort of, yeah, less impressive infantry. Saga just has lists for these armies, and you just go, okay, my Vikings are fighting your Normans.
We're using those armies.
So this is actually one that's remarkably not, you need to be particularly creative in terms of the forces played. partially because a lot of medieval rule sets are written with flexibility in mind, because the period is fairly broad, and did X fight Y is actually a pretty narrow, like, if you're writing for these things, it's pretty narrow. So they instead go very broad and have a mechanism for handling armies over what is a several hundred year period of time.
I have a feeling that I'm going to end up painting another random pile of Normans and Vikings for use with this. Because I already have Saxons, so just like another bag of Normans, another bag of Vikings, and go, cool, we can do whatever we want with this.
You can tie all of these together and be like, okay, what actually happens with this is that the somewhat stronger Danish presence in England continues to support the Viking trading towns in Ireland, and eventually Ireland unites under a Viking king and then joins the Second World War.
And then, weird.
And then later the Cold War. The Irish could join the Cold War, because if they're on the side of the Allies, there's a good chance they end up in NATO. What if Ireland joined NATO? Not much happens, but...
A Viking Ireland joins NATO.
Yes, a united Viking Ireland joins NATO. That may be the episode title.
I mean, when you tell me that you've done that, I'm going to tell you it's time to come home. We miss you. Like,
no, I'm going deep.
Now comes the question of, we've talked about what this is and what we're doing with it, but now comes the big question that we get asked a lot by the people who care about us deeply. Why?
And so we're going to go through both the pros of this and the cons of this, because there are pros and cons. The pros are that this is a way to play historical games that still affords you a good deal of creativity. So a lot of our podcast is about making historicals somewhat more accessible. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to sort of slightly remove it from history and say, okay, this is close to history, but not quite. We see this a lot with what we're calling the sort of quasi-historical games, where like a really good way to get people interested in Napoleonics is, instead of fighting, you know, brigade level Leipzig fights with, you know, tons of miniatures, how about you're like seven dudes and we're going to go hunt vampires? This is a similar thing, is you can sort of divorce yourself a little bit from what actually happened and get a little bit more flexibility. Say, what if I don't want that? What if I do want, you know, paratroopers in North Africa? What does that mean? Things like that. So that's one pro. The other one is, it's just a fun creative exercise. Like, I have spent a lot of time recently not painting and not modeling, but thinking about what an Irish military in the Second World War would have looked like. What types of tanks are viable for them, what industry existed in Ireland that they could build themselves, what industry didn't, where they're reliant on lend lease. For example, found out that the Swedes built them two tanks in the 1930s that are sort of take a lot of design hints from what will eventually become German tanks. You know, so yeah, we have two L-60 tanks running around Ireland. Found out Ford had an armored car factory in Cork. And so, yeah, you can start thinking about, okay, what does that mean? What could they do? What couldn't they do? You know, the Irish are not going to be able to sustain a U.S. Army Air Corps or a Royal Air Force level strategic bombing campaign of Germany. It's just not going to happen. But could Irish sort of maritime patrol bombers be a menace in the Bay of Biscay? Sure. Some questions.
Could that pile of people who we do not ask where they were in the 1920s be told, hey, go blow up a bunch of bridges?
Yeah. Could you have gotten into mischief in France or Norway or things like that? Questions like that. Also questions like things like, okay, if the Irish Navy is building destroyers, what are they building destroyers to do? And the answer is, they're not dumb enough to think they can take on the Kriegsmarine. So we're talking about anti-submarine and escort duty. So maybe their destroyers are sort of more gun heavy and less torpedo heavy, because torpedoes are also expensive. And as we learned from the battle report, don't work. And so maybe they go with sort of gun heavy, like tribal class destroyers, rather than something else. Again, maybe their sort of lack of capacity to build full armored divisions actually means they arrive at combined arms units somewhat earlier than everybody else does by necessity, that tank formations will always be attached to infantry because that's the only way they ever show up. This is nice. This is a good pro. And the other thing is it's fun modeling. You can be like, ah, yes, but I want to do this other thing. What if I want mostly British-looking troops, but in half-tracks, because I like half-tracks better than universal carriers? Congratulations, you can come up with a justification for that. Those are the pros in my mind. The other major pro is for groups. So when we're talking about, you know, historicals are often framed as you and your buddy are playing, and you can sort of decide what you're playing. So like Calvin, do you want to play France? 90% of the time he'll say yes, and then we'll go, okay, who was fighting France? Okay, I'll play these guys. Instead, for groups, there's often this problem of like, okay, so Calvin is playing NATO, Kai is playing the Soviet Union, what does Eric play? And if I play NATO, Kai has to fight both of us, or we have to do the thing that all 40K players are familiar with, where you just go like, the Space Marines are having a live fire exercise, and that's why the Ultramarines are fighting the Imperial Fists again. With alternate history, you can make a version of this where it makes sense. So, for example, maybe the Swedes don't join either side, but are instead sort of actively defending their borders in both directions, because both sides are going, you know, it really would be nice if we could cut through the Swedish forest. And then the Swedish forest starts shooting back. So that's one way to do it. The Viking example is another good one. If you want who is playing these things, you just sort of tweak history such that, yeah, someone gets to play their Normans, someone gets to play their Saxons, someone gets to play their Vikings, and they all fight each other. So there's viable ways to do that. Those are the pros. Now we're going to talk about the cons.
Which there are a few. The biggest one on here is community buy-in, because at some level, you are homebrewing a number of things for this. And that does not work very well if you're doing a game that has like an organized competitive scene. You can always go, oh, these are my Irish, but I play them as British. Like, that's fine, where it's like, cool, I'm just using British equipment and Shermans and whatever. And that works fine. But if you come with anything really interesting for them, probably not going to work.
So like for some examples of things we've talked about in the after the Cruel Seas game we played yesterday, Calvin came up with a really good idea for inexperienced Irish motor torpedo boats, which is in the fiction we wrote, they were being essentially led by Royal Navy squadron leaders. What if we allow group activations? They're essentially the Irish boats will follow the Royal Navy boat in. That's a homebrew rule. That might feel really characterful. That might be super overpowered. It might not be. We don't know. We haven't played it yet. So things like that. Or we've been musing about what would the rules for Irish commandos be? And do we give them a rule where they're a little bit more, let's call it self-directed, so that the loss of an NCO might not be as big a deal to them as it is to some other forces? Those are things that feel very flavorful, very characterful. But those are homebrew rules. You just made those up. And so like somebody who just showed up and is like, I just want to play bolt action the way it's written, justifiably could say no to that. And that doesn't necessarily mean them being an ass. Homebrew rules often smack of power gaming and are inherently not balanced. They're also often not balanced in the other way, where you're like, it's really characterful that I don't get to take this. And it's like, yeah, but you really need to take this. Because we're going to use the 76 millimeter Shermans, for example. But you really need to take this because I've got two Panthers in my list. And I would really like my tanks not to just roll over everything. It would be nice if you could penetrate the front armor of my tanks. This also has implications for events. There are some historical events. I am not anticipating any of them are going to be okay with me showing up with the famed Irish 3rd Infantry Division in Sicily. Because why would they be? Now, again, for some proxies, it's easy enough. You know, my Cruel Seas fleet is a British fleet that conspicuously doesn't have any British flags on it and has camouflage scheme that looks credibly World War II, but isn't anybody's. Fine. Cool. Yeah, do that. But past that, you're going to have potentially some issues. And admittedly, like one of the major interests people have in historical games is recreating real things. we want to play this particular battle. You're not in that particular battle because you don't actually exist in history.
And that can lead to some issues.
Yeah. The other con, and this is one that I'm encountering right now, is lack of model support for obscure or fictional units. So this is made better thanks to 3D printing. For example, there is indeed a Landsverk L60 STL for the whole two Ireland had. But I, for example, cannot find a model of the Ford armored car that was produced in Ireland. I can find things similar to it, but there does have to be a little bit of an abstraction. Tiny flags to put on, say, hypothetical ships. No one is making teeny tiny Irish flags. We don't actually know what the flag of United Ireland would look like. We really don't. Weirdly, someone is producing teeny tiny Irish transfers for airplanes for all four Gloucester Gladiators they had. I bought some of those, but that brings up another point. Transfers. The transfer sheet that comes with your M4 doesn't include decals for your force because Warlord wasn't anticipating your force. You know, there can be a lack of models. There can be a lack of rules. I wrote 4 blog posts on how to represent Swedish tanks in 7 Days to the River Rhine because it's not represented in 7 Days to the River Rhine. So yeah, these are all sort of downsides. And one of the pros is actually also a con, which is this results in a way deeper dive into things versus I think the 101st Airborne are neat. You can get into bolt action by buying a bolt action starter set and asking very few questions. And that works. It is harder to do that if you are running some sort of weird alternate history army that you do have to justify some of these things.
And this is also not, we are not knocking the, I think the 101st Airborne is neat. I'm going to do them. More power to you. Do it.
Yeah, I will say, for example, that the a good example is me. I have a first para army for the British, and that is because I think they're neat. I watched Bridge Too Far when I was a kid and thought it was a great movie. It is a great movie. I watched it recently. And then also, like, Empress Miniatures had a one-click, if you back our campaign and press this button, you have a full chain of command army. I did that, and it's done. So yeah, like, I don't actually think that that's a bad thing. It's just the history of the 101st Airborne is written. You don't have to source what planes were being manufactured in Northern Ireland in 1940 and how well did those planes do. The answer to that is the Short Brothers had a factory in Ireland and produced a decent medium heavy bomber, the Stirling, and a flying boat, the Sunderland. And so, like, basing a lot of things off those two.
Commissioning someone to sculpt you a specific 3D model of an alternate history.
Yes. We will go into that in a bit, because that's down there. But yeah, so it's an availability problem. It's not the easiest path for this.
And that also kind of hits one of our things, is we want to make this accessible. And some of these aren't as accessible.
Yeah, this is sort of a, it is more accessible in terms of you have a hard counter to the rivet counters because your stuff isn't real. But at the same time, it does take a lot of work. Now, one of the questions is, how do you actually source alternate histories? If you're like, I want to do this, how do you get started?
Well, let's start with your favorite way of doing these.
So my favorite way is the good people at Paradox Games make a number of historical strategy games. So Hearts of Iron covers World War II. Victoria covers sort of the Industrial Revolution. Europa Universalis covers before Victoria. And then Crusader Kings 3 now covers basically from about 850 or so up to sort of the end of the Crusades. And all of these essentially propagate alternate histories for you. So, for example, I have played one of my favorite, and it is indeed the sort of seed for this, is I did play a Hearts of Iron game that brings up that Ireland could join the Allies, and I went, oh, hell yeah. Joined the Allies, and this ends with the 1st Irish Expeditionary Division being the first troops into Moscow in 1948, following the British dropping an atomic bomb on Moscow. There's clearly lots of things that happen in between there, but that's a good alternate history.
There is, for things like Crusader Kings, you can play one of the Viking kingdoms in England and try to hold on to your power. I had a game that ended up, weirdly, with England being split between the Swedish Empire and the Holy Roman Empire, as one does. So Paradox Games are really good at generating things like that. You can play around with it, sort of explore some of the ideas behind it. Generally speaking, if you're playing on easy levels, your alternate history will be wildly more successful than it probably should be. So play them on hard. But you can, for example, get out of that, and that is what I got out of it and why I started thinking about this, that early in the Second World War, Ireland is very constricted as to what it can do, simply because it doesn't have much stuff. And like trying to build a battleship will take longer than the game is going to run. So you start thinking about how can I be impactful while still sort of playing the game. And for me, that involved a lot of Irish air power on helping patrol the North Sea and the Bay of Biscay. So there's Paradox Games. Calvin, you want to talk about novels?
There are countless novels that cover alternate history things. I don't know any of them off the top of my head because that's not normally the stuff I read, but they exist. Team Yankee, for example, was a novel first before they made it into a game. And these exist. There's a lot of Cold War Goes Hot stuff. Tom Clancy, any number of things. There exists enough books about various alternate histories to have a podcast of their own.
Some classic ones, again, Harry Turtledove, started with Guns of the South, which was a science fiction book about what happens if some South African pro-apartheid folks give the Confederacy AK-47s. That's a little bit outside the realm of possibility, but he sort of dialed that back for later ones and was really interested in exploring what would have happened. I will give Harry Turtledove credit. In his mind, the Confederates winning is not a good thing and sort of makes everything worse. And he's been very clear about that on Twitter. There are tons of what if Nazis or the Confederates won, which at this point is, I think, a little bit of a cringe cliche. Probably the most prominent one of these is now an Amazon TV special, The Man in the High Tower. Candidly, there was no way for them to win without some serious changes. You've got to actually dig pretty deep into history to get that.
You see,
Calvin does, however, have a soft spot for one.
Yeah. Yeah. So first off, on the serious changes, when you declare war on the bottomless manpower of the USSR at the time and the bottomless resources of the United States, you are going to have a bad time. Like, there's no way out of that. But the soft spot is a kind of garbage video game that I played a whole lot of as a kid called Turning Point: Fall of Liberty. And I like that because it turns a small change into a very big one, where the premise of the game is that Winston Churchill did get hit by a taxi when he was visiting New York before World War II. He didn't die. He lived, walked with a cane, but like, he lived. This posits, what if he died? And then you have, you know, Chamberlain leading the UK. They fall. The United States never enters the war. It does devolve into quasi-historical later of like Nazi airships and power armored soldiers. But the game lets you kill a whole lot of Nazis. So that's
fair
fun.
Enough. So yeah, there's lots and lots of novels about alternate history. One of the other ways is just by reading history and noting particular turning points, especially small ones. Things where like, oh, if X didn't happen, and it's some minor, trivial, stupid thing, this wouldn't have taken place. So, for example, if you want a what if the Confederates won, Stonewall Jackson gets shot by a sentry on his side. What if that didn't happen? You have one of Lee's better generals is alive at some times. So you can do those sort of small changes where just what if this thing doesn't happen? The other one to look for is things that begin or end eras. So 1066 is a great one for this. Like, the Norman invasion of England is a historical turning point. The Battle of Hastings happens and has consequences. What if it goes a different way?
Another example of that could be, what if the Prussians don't show up at Waterloo?
Yeah. What if the Prussians don't show up at Waterloo? A lot of things like that happen. What if the Lusitania doesn't sink? And the U.S. continues to sort of hem and haw on whether or not it enters the war. This is one of the things you could do, for example, if you wanted to make Ireland joins a bigger deal, is apparently Hitler was avoiding sort of bombing Ireland as a way of avoiding antagonizing the Americans, because America is full of Irish immigrants. So if the Irish join the war, does America join the war sooner as one of the major blocks that is sort of like, I don't know, goes whole hog, no, let's do this. So there's questions that you can ask like that that are turning points. But yeah, it's really look for anything that begins or ends an era, that changes the way something works, that would have killed somebody whose name you recognize before they become super important. These are all really good ways to look at potentially alternative histories.
Another fun idea that, like, this is just me spitballing from hearing one thing. What if Mexico decides to join Germany with the Zimmermann telegram and do some stuff?
And we have another front that the U.S. has to fight on that keeps the U.S. distracted for a bit.
There's reasons they didn't do it that were extraordinarily good, but what if they didn't? And then that kind of leads to the thing of the modeling and the gaming, which we all love here. There's the easy way to do it, which is I'm going to use the same equipment and paint it slightly differently. And then there's the way of pain.
Yeah, so this is what I'm doing for the Irish. So the easy way for the Irish would, for example, to go the Irish or the English. And I'm just going to go a little bit transfer light on my tanks, and it'll be fine. The other way to do this is to... And this is, for example, what I'm doing with Sweden, basically for everything, is the Battlefront folks make some Swedish tanks for 7 days to the River Rhine. I bought their starter set. That's what I'm using. Similarly, for something like 0200 hours or any of the scenarios where we're talking about like the Spetsnaz getting up to no good in Sweden, I bought some Special Air Service Arctic dudes and some Bundeswehr dudes from, I think, Empress and someone else. And I'm just calling it good. You know, the SAS dudes look like they have heavy packs and warm clothes. And the Bundeswehr dudes look like generic European, Northern European soldiers in camouflage. So I will paint them. I will Google an appropriate camouflage scheme. It'll be green. And we'll give them that. That's the easy way. The Irish are following the way of pain, which is partially sourcing. You know, there's going to be a bunch of American tanks in with a bunch of British stuff, which means a bunch of starter sets don't work because, conveniently, I also don't really like the Universal Carrier. So I'm going to buy some half tracks. Got to figure out what type of armored car they use. I think we're going to use the Wolverine because I think it looks neat. And I have some just-so story about why it works. But then things like decals. I am currently commissioning someone to do decals so that the sides of my tanks look like Irish tanks, not British tanks or American tanks. I am also commissioning someone to, for Cruel Seas, you can have aircraft. One of them is a Bew Fighter. I'm commissioning someone to develop the Short Selkie, which is essentially the Irish heavy fighter that gets developed in this particular setting where the Irish realize that they do need air defense. They need to be able to shoot down bombers, but things like the BF-109 are largely out of range. So it becomes a heavy bomber, heavy fighter war. And what comes out of that is the Short brothers are commissioned to build an airplane called the Short Selkie and then the Short Super Selkie. I have someone who's done some sculpting of essentially what if historical airplanes for Aeronautica Imperialis. I've got him working on what would this look like. Things like that. I have tracked down an STL for the two L-60s so that if Calvin ever wants to play a very early war German invasion of Ireland, or I also have a hilarious what if the Irish counter-invaded England during Operation Sea Lion, which I have called Operation Piecemeal. And like, yeah, the Irish land in like Wales to try to relieve the British. I'm going to have some L-60 tanks, all two of them, so that we can fight like Panzer 1s versus L-60s. So like, but I had to go track down that STL.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the way of pain, is doing a lot of customizing, a lot of thinking about what would, you know, heraldry look like, what would unit identifications look like, what would units look like? Like, one of the things we briefly talked about is, like, do the Irish use the pia or the bazooka? And if you decide that the anti-tank rocket launcher of choice for the Irish is the bazooka, now you've got to figure out how to model English dudes with bazookas when most of them come with piats. Boo. Yeah. So, like, that can go as deep as you want it to. And so you can do a lot of things. You could, for example, I am assuming that the Irish dress primarily like the British and Canadians do. I could decide that that's not true and go down that rabbit hole forever and ever and ever.
Because there is precedent for, like, Americans to be outfitting entire countries, because that's what they did with the Free French.
Yeah, maybe I decide that the Irish would look mostly like GIs, but with different helmets or something. And, like, now I need to kit bash a bunch of stuff. So that's sort of the way of pain. But again, that army is yours in a way that very few historical armies are, because it's unique to you and you did it. That's sort of fun. And then I will end up with a bunch of transfer sheets with harps on them, which is not the worst thing in the world. But yeah, so that's sort of how we've been thinking about alternate history and how it applies to historical gaming. Calvin, do you have any further thoughts, closing ideas?
I almost want to see if I can convince you to make some... Do the Irish go to North Africa, you know?
With our incredibly obsolete tanks.
Well, not even that. I'm thinking about them being part of the, like, you know, first wave of special forces being created in North Africa with stuff like the Lawrence Desert Group, the SAS, Popsky's Private Army, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I had started, in my mind, the Irish are largely stuck on Ireland until the invasion of Sicily, but there's no reason small units can't be either part of that or part of Operation Torch.
Yeah.
And have them essentially join up with the Americans in the middle of the Atlantic and then get creamed at the Kasserine Pass along with everyone else. So yeah, you could have the Irish in North Africa, which would be fun. And would give me an excuse to, again, one of the things I'm interested in is, like, what does a force that is using primarily second echelon tanks look like? And by Sicily, and especially by Normandy, that's still a Sherman. Whereas earlier in the war, you are talking about, like, hand-me-down
Stuarts.
Valentines and Stuarts and things like that. So, like, what does that look like? So that's a potentially interesting idea.
I figured I'd throw that idea out there as, you know, my love of the North African campaign is an all-encompassing.
And yes. At some point, I will have to figure out a way to have a North Africa-related army so that I can play with you, because that is indeed your one true love.
I mean, you don't have to. I have three now.
True, but I want to.
Actually, there's four. There's a fourth one that's being built, which...
And we have desert terrain.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of it. If you want to do alternate history, hell yeah, go for it. We support it.
Like, yeah, I think it's an incredibly fun way to interact with things. And I think one of the important bits is a alternate history army is often very good for the third player in a campaign, because you can find ones that sort of counter either army, or at least have an excuse to be shooting at either army in a way that I think often is a struggle for small but greater than two people groups to participate in larger campaigns.
Yeah, and that is, I guess, one of the benefits of one of the things that we're going to have to do a power ranking of, like, all the various settings we do at some point for, like, various things of, like, you know, whether they're good for... Wait, no, that was our... We did our whole episode on, like, the periods we play.
Yeah. We'll revisit that again at some point. 30 Years War is S tier. That's...
Yeah.
This is mainly because also me and another one of our clubmates, Russell, are currently trying to figure out how to do Bocage in a way that we don't find unsatisfying. And that turns out to be a non-trivial challenge. And that's because it's in France. If we just stuck with the 30 Years War, I wouldn't have to be dealing with Bocage. So yeah, there's a lot of fun there. I think I threatened at some point to have Prussian troops in an American Civil War game.
Yeah.
Because I decided that this was the British help the Confederates, and so the Prussians helped the United States to counter British influence, but they don't do it consensually. They just sort of show up and are like, hello, America, we're here to help, to give me an excuse to shoot at both of you. Because again, didn't want to have two Union players and one Confederate player, or two Confederate players and one Union player. So I was just like, what if the Germans show up?
More German mercenaries.
Yeah, just more German mercenaries. In the grand tradition of wars, someone on the side call independence wars, of German mercenaries showing up. What if that is revisited in, 1864? Did not end up doing that, but there's some Perry Brother plastics that would let me. And so, yeah, that's about it. If you like alternate history, do it. If you're finding it hard to be a third player, one that just came to mind that would be really good for a World War II campaign you guys are doing. Someone's playing the Allies and someone's playing the Axis. Republican Spain. What if Republican Spain wins the Spanish Civil War? They are expressly anti-fascist. So maybe they go to war with Germany, but they're also communists. And the Western Allies had pretty strong feelings about that. And the Soviet Union's rather far away. So maybe the British or Americans decide to try to knock off the Spanish once things seem largely under control in France. This is a perfectly good way to have a three-way war that's still ostensibly about World War II. So we're going to close it out here. Thank you all for listening to this. If you would like to support the show, we do have a Patreon at www.patreon.com/plasticpressgangpodcast. That primarily goes to support our lovely editor, who will hopefully make that sequence sound slightly less embarrassing for me.
Or, alternatively, we tell him to just leave it in and make it comedy.
Yeah, that also happens. We are available at plasticpressgang@gmail.com if you want to send in questions. Members of the Patreon get access to our Discord, where we are both extremely widely available. I am on Twitter at @VarianceHammer, and then Calvin, you have a number of social medias.
Yes, I have my Twitter, as long as that site exists, at Brushes and Jazz. You can find me on Twitch at Nevermore Painting, where I paint toy soldiers and rant about whatever I feel like, much like this podcast, but less structured. And also, I believe, Eric, you have a couple other things where if people like listening to you.
Yeah, if you have not gotten enough of my voice yet and want to hear my thoughts on, at this point, primarily Heresy and 8mm Warhammer products, but also Warhammer generally, I am also a co-host of Lost to the Nails, which is a podcast with Brian Harvey, who was formerly the host of Splintermind, where we talk about Warhammer in all its forms. As I said, right now we're on sort of a Heresy kick, and yeah, that podcast comes out at times. It is much less regular, thanks to both Brian's schedule and mine, but it's a good time if you like the sort of conversational style of this one. And that's about it for us.
Plug your blog.
I also have a blog. Sorry, I have been neglecting the blog because all my good ideas go to either Plastic Press Gang or Lost in the Nails. I'm also on variancehammer.com, hence the Twitter handle at @variancehammer. That is a occasionally quantitative look at wargaming. So it has more numbers in it because numbers make for bad radio, but decent blogging. And then also extended stuff about the hobby, my thoughts, etc. This is where, for example, if you did want to read 4 posts about me trying to break down the point formula for 7 Days to the River Rhine, and then reverse engineer it for Swedish and French tanks, that is where you would find that. Thank you for reminding me, Calvin.
Yeah, and actually, it's not even that neglected. You had a post last week or this week?
Yes, I'm reviewing Rick Priestley's book on wargame design. The short version is okay.
It's a B.
Yep.
That seems like all our correct plugs. I would also like to shout out our lovely support staff in the form of Adrian, our editor, who makes us sound better than we deserve, honestly. And our awesome artist, Space Art Punk, on Twitter and on Twitch, who created the lovely little cartoons you see of us in the logo for the podcast. Also, the questions are still open for you to have us answer them live on stream, which will happen when we have time.
Someday, trademark.
That's actually everything now. We're actually done.
See you all in the next episode.